This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And today, on this 44th anniversary of the assassination of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., we consider some of his hopes, dreams, and assessments of how far the movement had come at the end of his life, and to discuss the contemporary implications of the King legacy. We are joined live today by Kevin Gray. He is the author of Waiting for Lightning to Strike, The Fundamentals of Black Politics, as well as The Decline of Black Politics from Malcolm X to Barack Obama. Kevin is with us live, joining us from South Carolina. Good afternoon, sir.
Good afternoon. Are you there?
Yes, we are. Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Well, Kevin, it's always a pleasure and a revelation to have you on because of the critical analytical way in which you approach Black history, the legacy of the civil rights movement, and the contortions of history we find ourselves in today. Why don't we just open up the floor for your assessment of where we have come since 1968?
That's a big question. You know, and I'm working on trying to finish that second book, The Decline of Black Politics, which I've been working on for about 10 years now. And I started working on it before Barack Obama became president. And Barack Obama becoming president didn't make it any easier to write that book because it's, you know, you got a, your first person of color as president, and people are saying, well, why do you see a decline? But, you know, when you look at where Dr. King was when he died, being opposed to empire, when he died, you had right about 100 black elected officials. Now you have over 10,000. A lot of people like to talk about the mountaintop speech, the dream speech, but I think that, and the Riverside speech, which was, of course, an important speech. But I always go back to the Other America speech where he talks about black and inner city unemployment. At the time he gave the speech, he was right at 8%. Now it's probably doubled that. You know, and I just finished talking to another friend. I said, if Dr. King were alive today and had the same politics, then a lot of people would be against him because he would, you know, his politics would be the antithesis of what we see coming out the White House and this idea of cheering on empire. So, you know, in a way, Dr. King's martyred life and the fact that we do pause to at least examine his life on his birthday and on his assassination date makes us think about the idea of empire, the idea that our country has been at war almost every 20 years since its existence, the idea that our country is willing to spend money on war but not on health care, that, you know, we're still fighting for justice all around the country. It's not just about one case with Trayvon Martin, but it's about Troy Davis, it's about Ramali Graham, it's about, you know, Oscar Grant, it's about Sean Bell, it's about the folk at the end of a drone in Afghanistan or Pakistan. It's about going to war with Iraq, thinking that with the majority of the American people thinking that Iraq somehow bombed the buildings in New York on 9/11. It's about you know, still fighting for workers' rights and the right and for human rights and civil rights for poor people, economic rights for poor people, and the need to create another America. Dr. King said America had to be born again, and it hasn't faced that rebirth. Surely, you know, there's diversity in government, but it's diversity that's presiding over the misery that's existed for a lot of people for a long time.
Clarence Thomas is black, but the system remains the same. The speech that you pay particular attention to, not the only one, of course, is the April 4th, 1967 speech given at Riverside Church in New York City, Beyond Vietnam. And certainly the empire that you speak of, the military encroachment of the United States on all parts of the globe, the new initiatives in Africa, and the remote control assassination of people. We were speaking earlier and observed that at least Nixon did not assassinate Jane Fonda. when she went to Vietnam, but this black president has reserved the right and codified it to do so.
You know, I was watching the news today, and that's one of his talking points that he sent out to all the surrogates in his reelection bid, and we got Osama bin Laden. Now, I listened this morning, I think it was MSNBC, he got Osama bin Laden. They dare not use the word assassinate, but he is the assassination president. And people need to reconcile what that means.
So
and
it's,
I'm
sorry.
Even with Enda and what is the difference between a non-judicial assassination that the government, via the commander-in-chief, gave for Osama bin Laden or Alawi, and George Zimmerman summarily executing Trayvon Martin? What is the difference?
You remind us of one of the Reverend Doctor's more famous admonitions about paying attention to the content of one's character rather than the color of the president's skin. The point being that race is no longer a guarantee, if it ever was, of communitarian principles aimed at uplifting the in-group as well as the out-group simultaneously. In that context, there was a great moment, a great coherence among African-American people and people of goodwill across the country. Now that seems much more fragmented, as well as the purpose of a movement.
First of all, we need a left movement in the country. And we need the left, the radical left, the progressive left, to be just as organized and just as vociferous as their so-called radical right, evangelical right. Now, that being said, you know, most people believe that any movement for social justice is going to be led by those who are really affected the most grievously by the injustice of a particular kind of system. And so when you historically look at who America has oppressed, well, Native American and black people. But, you know, as you see with Barack Obama, as you see with this idea of black elected officials and folk like to run the empire, and they'll cheer the empire as long as they're running it. It's almost as though the empire said to whoever runs it, you know, if we put these people in charge of their own misery, they'll holler and complain a whole lot less. So, I mean, that's the thing that we're dealing with now. Even when you hear people talk about Dr. King's dream is realized through having a black president, well, you know, that's not what Dr. King was about. But that's where a lot of people are. Part of the problem is not having a consistent, coherent left movement in this country. And that's what we need to build. And we need to build it locally, and we need to build it consistently, which is what, you know, you have the Green Party that might do it in fits and starts. In the black community, you've got parachute leadership that will parachute down into your community if you got a problem, and they suck up all the oxygen of the problem, but they're not creating any all the press that they can get. But there's nothing institutional, there's nothing structural, there's nothing democratic that's being created.
One other thing, Kevin Gray, the movement of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and SNCC and all of the other civil rights movements spoke about segregation and equal access, but there were so many other issues, including Operation Breadbasket, nutrition, food, education. And has the ball been dropped on the less obvious forms of discrimination in which people are, you know, shunted to neighborhoods that don't have quite the same services or don't have the full digital access and so on? What about the universal needs of the movement?
Well, as I said, the universal needs of the movement, I would think, would be retraining the community or reteaching the community about what a freedom movement is about, which might mean creating freedom schools and a different kind of organizational structure on the local level, something different from the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, of course, which I got my start in, but you know, something more secular, more democratic, not based on traditional paternalistic male lead models. That seems to be the problem that I see in the black community. And then again, you know, how do we deal with exploitation? How do we deal with co-optation? Because a lot of what we see in black political organizations today are organizations that are sponsored by the very people that they claim to fight. That therein lies a big problem with what they stand for. I mean, Wells Fargo supports just about every so-called black organization that's chartered, from NAN to the NAACP to the Rainbow Coalition. And let's just call it like it is. I mean, and some of these cats are my friends, and I, you know, some of them I even love, but they're co-opted, and they're not, you know, it's not about the people, it's about getting that big check. And it's about being out front, but it's not about solving any institutional problems or being serious about organizing. And they're going from pillar to post, from issue to issue, or crises to crises, without building anything long-lasting.
Well, Kevin Gray, I intend to extend this discussion with you in future days and weeks on the reconstruction of a universal movement that includes racial as well as economic and other forms of equity. And I promise you that we'll do this not only in the month of February, and not only on the 15th of January, and not only on the 4th of April.
All right, my brother.
Tell people where they can follow your work. Very compelling pieces you've written, including the one, The Decline of Black Politics from Malcolm X to Barack Obama, as well as Waiting for Lightning to Strike, The Fundamentals of Black Politics. Where can people follow you?
Well, you can go to Counterpunch, you can go to Progressive, you can go to my blog, The New Liberator. I think it's at WordPress. And, of course, my stuff is at AK Press, and the Decline of Black Politics is coming out on Verso. And I do a serious satellite radio show every Sunday, live from Land of Hopes and Dreams with Dave Marsh.
Well, thank you so much. And we've been speaking live with Kevin Gray in South Carolina. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacific Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York, along with Thiago Barroso and Michael G. Haskins. And we now take a look at one of the most analytical speeches by the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, delivered on the 16th of August, 1967. It was his final annual report to the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, where he addressed Operation Breadbasket and the state of the civil rights movement. And yet, despite some advances, King was acutely aware that war, economics, and racism left the American Negro stranded on the road between slavery and injustice. Or as he puts it, we still have a long, long, long way to go before we reached the promised land of freedom. Here now, Dr. King's State of the Black Nation Address of August 16th, 1967, titled, Where Do We Go From Here?
With all the struggle and all the achievements, we must face the fact, however, that the Negro still lives in the basement of the great society. He is still at the bottom, despite the few who have penetrated to slightly higher levels. Even where the door has been forced partially open, mobility for the Negro is still sharply restricted. There's often no bottom at which to start, and when there is, there's almost no room at the top. In consequence, Negroes are still impoverished aliens in an affluent society. They are too poor even to rise with the society, too impoverished by the ages to be able to ascend by using their own resources. The Negro did not do this himself. It was done to him. For more than half of his American history, he was enslaved. Yet he built the spanning bridges, the grand mansions, the sturdy docks, and stout factories of the South. His unpaid labor made cotton king and established America as a significant nation in international commerce. Even after his release from chattel slavery, the nation grew over him, submerging him. It became the richest, most powerful society in the history of man, but it left the Negro far behind. so we still have a long, long way to go before we reach the promised land of freedom. Yes, we have left the dusty soils of Egypt, and we have crossed a Red Sea that had for years been hardened by a long and piercing winter of massive resistance. But before we reach the majestic shores of the promised land, there will still be gigantic mountains of opposition ahead and prodigious hilltops of injustice. We still need some Paul Revere of conscience to alert every hamlet and every village of America that revolution is still at hand. Yes, we need a chart. We need a compass. Indeed, we need some North Star to guide us into a future shrouded with impenetrable uncertainties. Now, in order to answer the question, where do we go from here, which is our theme, we must first honestly recognize where we are now. When the Constitution was written, a strange formula to determine taxes and representation declared that the Negro was 60% of a person. Today, another curious formula seems to declare he is 50% of a person. Of the good things in life, the Negro has approximately one half those of whites. Of the bad things of life, he has twice those of whites. Thus, half of all Negroes live in substandard housing, and Negroes have half the income of whites. When we turn to the negative experiences of life, the Negro has a double share. There are twice as many unemployed. The rate of infant mortality among Negroes is double that of whites. There are twice as many Negroes dying in Vietnam as whites in proportion to their size and the population. In other spheres, the figures are equally alarming. In elementary schools, Negroes lag 1 to 3 years behind whites, and their segregated schools receive substantially less money per student than the white schools. 1/20th as many Negroes as whites attend college. Of employed Negroes, 75% hold menial jobs. This is where we are. Where do we go from here? First, we must massively assert our dignity and worth. We must stand up amid a system that still oppresses us and develop an unassailable and majestic sense of values. We must no longer be ashamed of being black. The job of arousing manhood within a people that have been taught for so many centuries that they are nobody is not easy. Even semantics have conspired to make that which is black seem ugly and degrading. In Roget's thesaurus, there are some 120 synonyms for blackness, and at least 60 of them are offensive, such words as blot, sup, grim, devil, and foul. There are some 134 synonyms for whiteness, and all are favorable, expressed in such words as purity, cleanliness, chastity, and innocence. A white lie is better than a black lie. The most degenerate member of a family is the black sheep. Arthur Davis has suggested that maybe the English language should be reconstructed so that teachers will not be forced to teach the Negro child 60 ways to despise himself and thereby perpetuate his false sense of inferiority, and the white child 134 ways to adore himself and thereby perpetuate his false sense of superiority. Tendency to ignore the Negro's contribution to American life and strip him of his personhood is as old as the earliest history books and as contemporary as the morning's newspaper, to offset this cultural homicide, the Negro must rise up with an affirmation of his own Olympian manhood. Any movement for the Negro's freedom that overlooks this necessity is only waiting to be buried. As long as the mind is enslaved, the body can never be free. Psychological freedom, a firm sense of self-esteem, is the most powerful weapon against the long night of physical slavery. No Lincolnian Emancipation Proclamation, no Johnsonian Civil Rights Bill can totally bring this kind of freedom. The Negro will only be free when he reaches down to the inner depths of his own being and signs with the pen and ink of assertive manhood his own Emancipation Proclamation. And with a spirit straining toward true self-esteem, the Negro must boldly throw off the manacles of self-abnegation and say to himself and to the world, I am somebody. I am a person. I am a man with dignity and honor. I have a rich and noble history, however painful and exploited that history has been. Yes, I was a slave through my foreparents. And now I'm not ashamed of that. I'm ashamed of the people who were so sinful to make me a slave. Yes. Yes, we must stand up and say, I'm black, but I'm black and beautiful. This self-affirmation is the black man's need made compelling by the white man's crimes against him. Now, another basic challenge is to discover how to organize our strength into economic and political power. And no one can deny that the Negro is in dire need of this kind of legitimate power. Indeed, one of the great problems that the Negro confronts is his lack of power. From the old plantations of the South to the newer ghettos of the North, the Negro has been confined to a life of voicelessness and powerlessness, stripped of the right to make decisions concerning his life and destiny. He has been subject to the authoritarian and sometimes whimsical decisions of the white power structure. The plantation and the ghetto were created by those who had power, both to confine those who had no power and to perpetuate their powerlessness. Now, the problem of transforming the ghetto, therefore, is a problem of power, a confrontation between the forces of power demanding change and the forces of power dedicated to the preserving of the status quo. Now, power properly understood is nothing but the ability to achieve purpose. It is the strength required to bring about social, political, and economic change. Walter Ruther defined power one day. He said, power is the ability of a labor union like UAW to make the most powerful corporation in the world, General Motors, say yes when it wants to say no. That's power. Now, a lot of us are preachers, and all of us have our moral convictions and concerns, and so often we have problems with power. There is nothing wrong with power. Power is used correctly. You see, what happened is that some of our philosophers got off base. And one of the great problems of history is that the concepts of love and power have usually been contrasted as opposites, polar opposites. so that love is identified with a resignation of power and power with a denial of love. It was this misinterpretation that caused the philosopher Nietzsche, who was the philosopher of the will to power, to reject the Christian concept of love. It was the same misinterpretation which induced Christian theologians to reject Nietzsche's philosophy of the will to power in the name of the Christian idea of love. Now, we got to get this thing right. What is needed is a realization that power without love is reckless and abusive, and that love without power is sentimental and anemic. Power at its best. Power at its best is love, implementing the demands of justice, and justice at its best is love correcting everything that stands against love. And this is what we must see as we move on. Now, what has happened is that we've had it wrong and mixed up in our country. And this has led Negro Americans in the past to seek their goals through love and moral suasion devoid of power, and white Americans to seek their goals through power devoid of love and conscience. It is leading a few extremists today to advocate for Negroes the same destructive and conscienceless power that they have justly abhorred in whites. It is precisely this collision of immoral power with powerless morality which constitutes the major crisis of our time. And we must develop progress, or rather the program, and I can't stay on this long, that will drive the nation to a guaranteed annual income. Now, early in the century, this proposal would have been greeted with ridicule and denunciation as destructive of initiative and responsibility. At that time, economic status was considered the measure of the individual's abilities and talents. And in the thinking of that day, the absence of worldly goods indicated a want of industrious habits and moral fiber. We've come a long way in our understanding of human motivation and of the blind operation of our economic system. Now we realize that dislocations in the market operation of our economy and the prevalence of discrimination thrust people into idleness and bind them in constant or frequent unemployment against their will. The poor are less often dismissed, I hope, from our conscience today by being branded as inferior and incompetent. We also know that no matter how dynamically the economy develops and expands, it does not eliminate all poverty. The problem indicates that our emphasis must be twofold. We must create full employment, or we must create incomes. People must be made consumers by one method or the other. Once they are placed in this position, we need to be concerned that the potential of the individual is not wasted. New forms of work that enhance the social good will have to be devised for those for whom traditional jobs are not available. In 1879, Henry George anticipated this state of affairs when he wrote in Progress and Poverty, "The fact is that the work which improves the condition of mankind, the work which extends knowledge and increases power and enriches literature and elevates thought, is not done to secure living. It is not the work of slaves driven to that task, either by the task of that of a taskmaster or by animal necessities. It is the work of men who somehow find a form of work that brings a security for its own sake. In a state of society where want is abolished, work of this sort could be enormously increased. And we are likely to find that the problem of housing, education, instead of preceding the elimination of poverty, will themselves be affected if poverty is first abolished. The poor transformed into purchasers will do a great deal on their own to alter housing decay. Negroes who have a double disability will have a greater effect on discrimination when they have the additional weapon of cash to use in their struggle. Beyond these advantages, a host of positive psychological changes inevitably will result from widespread economic security. The dignity of the individual will flourish when the decisions concerning his life are in his own hands, when he has the assurance that his income is stable and certain, and when he knows that he has the means to seek self-improvement. Personal conflicts between husband, wife, and children will diminish when the unjust measurement of human worth on a scale of dollars is eliminated. Now our country can do this. John Kenneth Galbraith said that a guaranteed annual income could be done for about $20 billion a year. And I say to you today that if our nation can spend $35 billion a year to fight an unjust, evil war in Vietnam and $20 billion to put a man on the moon, it can spend billions of dollars to put God's children on their own 2 feet right here on earth. Now let me rush on to say we must reaffirm our commitment to nonviolence. I want to stress this. The futility of violence in the struggle for racial justice has been tragically etched in all the recent Negro riots. Now, yesterday I tried to analyze the riots and deal with the causes for them. Today I want to give the other side. There's something painfully sad about a riot. One sees screaming youngsters and angry adults fighting hopelessly and aimlessly against impossible odds. Deep down within them you perceive a desire for self-destruction, a kind of suicidal longing. Occasionally, Negroes contend that the 1965 Watts riot and the other riots in various cities represented effective civil rights action. But those who express this view always end up with stumbling words when asked what concrete gains have been won as a result. At best, the riots have produced a little additional anti-poverty money allotted by frightened government officials, and a few water sprinklers to cool the children of the ghettos. It is something like improving the food in the prison while the people remain securely incarcerated behind bars. Nowhere have the riots won any concrete improvement, such as have the organized protest demonstrations. When one tries to pin down advocates of violence as to what acts would be effective, the answers are blatantly illogical. Sometimes they talk of overthrowing racist state and local governments, and they talk about guerrilla warfare. They fail to see that no internal revolution has ever succeeded in overthrowing a government by violence unless the government had already lost the allegiance and effective control of its armed forces. Anyone in his right mind knows that this will not happen in the United States. In a violent racial situation, the power structure has the local police, the state troopers, the National Guard, and finally the army to call on, all of which are predominantly white. Furthermore, few, if any, violent revolutions have been successful unless the violent minority had the sympathy and support of the non-resistant majority. Castro may have had only a few Cubans actually fighting with him and up in the hills, but he would have never overthrown the Batista regime unless he had had the sympathy of the vast majority of Cuban people. It is perfectly clear that a violent revolution on the part of American blacks would find no sympathy and support from the white population, and very little from the majority of the Negroes themselves. This is no time for romantic illusions and empty philosophical debates about freedom. This is a time for action. What is needed is a strategy for change, a tactical program that will bring the Negro into the mainstream of American life as quickly as possible. So far, this has only been offered by the nonviolent movement. Without recognizing this, we will end up with solutions that don't solve, answers that don't answer, and explanations that don't explain. And so I say to you today that I still stand by nonviolence. And I am still convinced. I'm still convinced that it is the most potent weapon available to the Negro in his struggle for justice in this country. And the other thing is, I'm concerned about a better world. I'm concerned about justice. I'm concerned about brotherhood. I'm concerned about truth. And when one is concerned about that, he can never advocate violence. For through violence you may murder a murderer, but you can't murder murder. Through violence you may murder a liar, but you can't establish truth. Through violence you may murder a hater, but you can't murder hate through violence. Darkness cannot put out darkness. Only light can do that. And I say to you, I've also decided to stick with love. But I know that love is ultimately the only answer to mankind's problems. And I'm going to talk about it everywhere I go. I know it isn't popular to talk about it in some circles today. And I'm not talking about emotional bosh when I talk about love. I'm talking about a strong, demanding love. But I have seen too much hate. I've seen too much hate on the faces of sheriffs in the South. I've seen hate on the faces of too many Klansmen and too many white citizens' counselors in the South to want to hate myself, because every time I see it, I know that it does something to their faces and their personalities. And I say to myself that hate is too great a burden to bear. I have decided to love it. If you're seeking the highest good, I think you can find it through love. And the beautiful thing is that we aren't moving wrong when we do it. Because John was right, God is love. He who hates does not know God. But he who loves has the key that unlocks the door to the meaning of ultimate reality. And so I say to you today, my friends, that you may be able to speak with the tongues of men and angels. You may have the eloquence of articulate speech, but if you have not love, it means nothing. Yes, you may have the gift of prophecy. You may have the gift of scientific prediction and understand the behavior of molecules. You may break into the storehouse of nature and bring forth many new insights. Yes, you may ascend to the heights of academic achievement so that you have all knowledge. And you may boast of your great institutions of learning and the boundless extent of your degrees, but if you have not love, all of these mean absolutely nothing. You may even give your goods to feed the poor. You may bestow great gifts to charity. You may tower high in philanthropy. But if you have not love, your charity means nothing. You may even give your body to be burned and die the death of a martyr, and your spilled blood may be a symbol of honor for generations yet unborn. and thousands may praise you as one of history's greatest heroes, but if you have not love, your blood was spilt in vain. What I'm trying to get you to see this morning is that a man may be self-centered in his self-denial and self-righteous in his self-sacrifice. His generosity may feed his ego, and his piety may feed his pride. So without love, benevolence becomes egotism, and martyrdom becomes spiritual pride. I want to say to you, as I move to my conclusion, as we talk about where do we go from here, we must honestly face the fact that the movement must address itself to the question of restructuring the whole of American society. There are 40 million poor people here. One day we must ask the question, why are there 40 million poor people in America? And when you begin to ask that question, you're raising a question about the economic system, about a broader distribution of wealth. When you ask that question, you begin to question the capitalistic economy. And I'm simply saying that more and more, we've got to begin to ask questions about the whole society. We are called upon to help the discouraged beggars in life's marketplace. But one day we must come to see that an edifice which produces beggars needs restructuring. It means that questions must be raised. You see, my friends, when you deal with this, you begin to ask the question, who owns the oil? You begin to ask the question, who owns the iron ore? You begin to ask the question, why is it that people have to pay water bills in a world that's two-thirds water? These are words that must be said. Now, don't think you have me in a bind today. I'm not talking about communism. What I'm talking about is far beyond communism. My inspiration didn't come from Karl Marx. My inspiration didn't come from Engels. My inspiration didn't come from Trotsky. My inspiration didn't come from Lenin. Yes, I read Communist Manifesto and Das Kapital a long time ago. And I saw that maybe Marx didn't follow Hegel enough. He took his dialectics, but he left out his idealism and his spiritualism, and he went over to a German philosopher by the name of Feuerbach and took his materialism and made it into a system that he called dialectical materialism. I have to reject that. What I'm saying to you this morning, communism forgets that life is individual. Capitalism forgets that life is social. And the kingdom of brotherhood is found neither in the thesis of communism nor the antithesis of capitalism, but in a higher synthesis. It's found in a higher synthesis that combines the truths of both. Now, when I say question in the whole society, it means ultimately coming to see that the problem of racism, the problem of economic exploitation, and the problem of war are all tied together. These are the triple evils that are interrelated. And if you will let me be a preacher just a little bit. One night a juror came to Jesus, and he wanted to know what he could do to be saved. Jesus didn't get bogged down on the kind of isolated approach of what you shouldn't do. Jesus didn't say, now, Nicodemus, you must stop lying. He didn't say, Nicodemus, now you must not commit adultery. He didn't say, now, Nicodemus, you must stop cheating if you're doing that. He didn't say, Nicodemus, you must stop drinking liquor if you're doing that excessively. He said something altogether different because Jesus realized something basic. That if a man will lie, he will steal. And if a man will steal, he will kill. So instead of just getting bogged down on one thing, Jesus looked at him and said, Nicodemus, you must be born again. In other words, your whole structure must be changed. A nation that will keep people in slavery for 244 years will thingify them and make them things. And therefore, they will exploit them and poor people generally, economically. And a nation that will exploit economically will have to have foreign investments and everything else, and it will have to use its military might to protect them. All of these problems are tied together. What I'm saying today is that we must go from this convention and say, America, you must be born again. So I conclude by saying today that we have a task, and let us go out the divine dissatisfaction. Let us be dissatisfied until America will no longer have a high blood pressure of creeds and an anemia of deeds. Let us be dissatisfied until the tragic walls that separate the outer city of wealth and comfort from the inner city of poverty and despair shall be crushed by the battering rams of the forces of justice. Let us be dissatisfied until they live on the outskirts of hope, are brought into the metropolis of daily security. Let us be dissatisfied until slums are cast into the junk heaps of history and every family will live in a decent sanitary home. Let us be dissatisfied until the dark yesterdays of segregated schools will be transformed into bright tomorrows of quality integrated education. Let us be dissatisfied until integration is not seen as a problem, but as an opportunity to participate in the beauty of diversity. Let us be dissatisfied until men and women, however black they may be, will be judged on the basis of the content of that character, not on the basis of the color of that skin. Let us be dissatisfied. Let us be dissatisfied until every state capital be housed by a governor who will do justly, who will love mercy, and who will walk humbly with his God. Let us be dissatisfied. Until from every city hall, justice will roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. Let us be dissatisfied until that day when the lion and the lamb shall lie down together. And every man will sit under his own vine and fig tree, and none shall be afraid. Let us be dissatisfied. And men will recognize that out of one blood, God made all men to dwell upon the face of the earth. Let us be dissatisfied until that day when nobody will shout white power, when nobody will shout black power, but everybody will talk about God's power and human power. I must confess, my friends, that The road ahead will not always be smooth. There will still be rocket paces of frustration, meandering points of bewilderment. There will be inevitable setbacks here and there. There will be those moments when the buoyancy of hope will be transformed into the fatigue of despair. Our dreams will sometime be shattered, and our ethereal hopes blasted. We may again, with tear-drenched eyes, have to stand before the bier of some courageous civil rights worker whose life will be snuffed out by the dastardly acts of bloodthirsty mobs. But difficult and painful as it is, we must walk on in the days ahead with an audacious faith in the future. And as we continue our chartered course, we may gain consolation from the words so nobly left by that great Black Bart, who was also a great freedom fighter of yesterday, James Weldon Johnson. Stony the road we trod, bitter the chastening rod felt in the days when hope unborn had died. Yet with a steady beat have not our weary feet come to the place for which our father sighed. We have come over a way that with tears has been watered. We have come treading our past through the blood of the slaughtered, out from the gloomy past, till now we stand at last where the bright gleam of our bright star is cast. Let this affirmation be our ringing cry. It will give us the courage to face the uncertainties of the future. It will give our tired feet new strength as we continue our forward stride toward the city of freedom. When our days become dreary with low hovering clouds of despair, when our nights become darker than a thousand midnights, let us remember that there is a creative force in this universe working to pull down the gigantic mountains of evil, a power that is able to make a way out of no way and transform dark yesterdays into bright tomorrows. Let us realize that the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. Let us realize that William Cullen Bryant is right. Truth crushed to earth will rise again. Let us go out realizing that the Bible is right. Be not deceived. God is not mocked. Whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. This is our hope for the future. With this faith, we will be able to sing in some not too distant tomorrow with a cosmic past tense. We have overcome. We have overcome. Deep in my heart, I did believe we would overcome.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. Today's program was engineered by Michael G. Haskins and produced with Thiago Veroso. If you have tips, comments, leaks, questions, or suggestions for 5 O'Clock Shadow, drop us an email at theshadow@wbai.org. And for 5 O'Clock Shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.